morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today's Tuesday, March 31st, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
A student-led march hit Salem today to voice concerns over the Western Oregon Plan Revision, or WOPR, and liquefied natural gas.
Better late than never, Oregon considers banning phosphorus in detergents.
And President Barack Obama is at the G20 summit trying to persuade the world that the dollar is still worth the trouble.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, rain this afternoon, highs around 50. Tonight, clouds and showers, lows around 40. Pretty much more of the same for the rest of the week, and maybe clearing up on Saturday.
And first, we go to regional news from around Cascadia. In Salem today, students are leading a rally to call legislators' attention to the two biggest rips in Oregon's green facade, LNG and, of course, the Western Oregon Plan Revision, or WOPR. Monica Vaughn with Cascadia Rising Tide joins us this morning to bring listeners up to speed on these two key issues. Good morning, Monica. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So what's going on in Salem today? I understand too that we'll be speaking with one of the demonstrators live in just a few moments. But just tell us what this particular demonstration is about.
Well, the Cascade Climate Network, which is a network of over 20 college campuses and universities and community colleges and high schools all throughout the Northwest, have organized a student lobby day around important climate change issues, including the governor's climate package, as well as the LNG Public Protection Act, and the House Resolution 3, which is regarding the WOPR. And students have come together to really, you know, look at this urgent issue of climate change and raise their voices to let representatives know what their opinions are about climate change, and particularly about these bills. And students are really concerned because the youth are going to be, you know, the ones dealing with climate change the most, and we're really interested in confronting some of the root causes of climate change, like deforestation and the development of new fossil fuels.
So basically, letting legislators know that it's all tied together and that we cannot legitimately think of ourselves as a green state if we don't address these problems.
That's absolutely right. And we have students coming from all over the state, from as far away as Ashland, and students who are coming from Forest Grove that is directly impacted by a pipeline proposed through that area. So there's a range of students that have come, including a group of students who have biked here to talk to their representatives about some transportation legislation.
Thank you so much, Monica. I think we have one of the demonstrators on the line right now. My guest has been Monica Vaughn with Cascadia Rising Tide. Thanks for that, Monica. And now we go to Salem to speak with one of the participants at today's demonstration, Joel Durr. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Chris.
So, can you give us an idea of what's going on right now and what you expect to accomplish?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Can you give us an idea of what's going on down there right now?
Yeah, there's a gathering of students from around the state coming together to talk to their elected representatives about issues that they find very important.
About how many people are there, would you estimate?
Probably about 35 people.
And you're going to be there for most of the day?
Yeah, we'll be here till about late afternoon talking to representatives.
And you yourself, what's your involvement, your personal involvement? Why are you there today?
Well, I'm involved with some student groups. I go to the University of Oregon, and we work on several issues that relate to climate and social justice. That's kind of what got me interested. And being a native Oregonian, I'm very concerned with, you know, the well-being of my state, environmentally, economically, socially, things like that.
Anything else that you'd like to tell KBOO listeners?
I would just say if you're concerned about any issue that's going on, you should definitely... You should talk to your elected representatives. They work for you. They want to hear what you have to say. So really, it makes their job easier if they know what their constituents want from them.
Thank you so much. That was Joel Durr. He joined us from the pro-environment rally taking place in Salem today. Thanks for that, Joel.
You're very welcome.
It's easy to bash Obama, but thus far has been one of the most open, honest efforts in American history. So go ahead, try to find something wrong here. President Obama signed legislation yesterday setting aside more than 2 million acres in 9 states as protected wilderness. He called the new law among the most important in decades, quote, to protect, preserve, and pass down our nation's most treasured landscapes to future generations.
Yesterday, the Oregon Senate voted to ban dishwasher detergents with high amounts of phosphorus. This brings the state in line with a dozen other states, including Washington. Phosphorus has long been regulated in cleaning agents such as laundry detergent, but until now, dishwasher soaps have gotten a pass. Environmentalists have been working hard over the past few years to convince states to tighten controls on the substance, which promotes the growth of algae blooms in rivers, lakes, and groundwater. The blooms essentially steal the oxygen from the water, suffocating other aquatic life.
The Obama administration won't defend the Bush administration's cuts to habitat protection for the threatened bull trout. The trout's need for cold, clean water can stand in the way of logging and mining on national forests. Conservation groups had sued to overturn the Bush administration's decision to cut critical habitat for the bull trout by about three-quarters in the Columbia and Klamath basins. Last week, lawyers for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service filed a motion saying they will take a new look at the fish's habitat needs.
Is there any natural resource we haven't completely tapped out? Hey, wait, there's still rocks. Tidewater Contractors of Brookings has proposed mining rock and gravel from the Elk River near Port Orford. In an application submitted to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the company says it would dredge 12,000 cubic yards of material annually for 5 years. The Army Corps is taking public comment on the proposed project until April 26th. No word yet from any environmentalists regarding lawsuits pending.
Air Cascadia has remained largely immune to the hysteria surrounding salmonella in peanut butter, but now seems like a good time to remind listeners that when you eat food from faraway places put on the shelves by multinational corporations, you're taking your chances. State officials say 4 Oregonians from the Portland area were among 42 sickened in a salmonella outbreak traced to ground pepper distributed by a California company, much of it to Chinese and Vietnamese establishments.
And just when you thought it was safe to go back to the bingo parlor, the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System has returned to the red. Back in 2003, the state pension system appeared to be on the brink of disaster. But after a series of reforms and robust investment returns, PERS emerged a few years later as one of the healthiest systems in the nation. Now, apparently, it's relapsed.
Yesterday, a bill imposing a nearly $16 a barrel surcharge on North Slope crude destined for Washington State was introduced in the Alaska House. It's a saber-rattling response to a bill in the Washington legislature that would tax fuel that's refined in Washington and exported to other states, including Alaska. And it continues the dangerous game of financial dice over fossil fuels.
President Barack Obama is in London today, where British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is hosting the G20 summit. Obama is expected to beg more stimulus money for the home team, but it's unlikely the Europeans will go along with it. What this is really about is China's massive presence in the room and loose cannons in Russia. KBOO's Spencer Raymond joins us to consider the implications. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning, Chris. Yeah, it's really at the G20 this week, and it's in London, as you mentioned. Gordon Brown is hosting, and it's basically going to be Brown and Obama versus Merkel, if you want to break it down that way. Obama is heading to the G20 with the notion that the stimulus ideas and the stimulus policies that his administration has really championed in the past several months is what other countries in the G20 should do also to get the world economy back on track. Gordon Brown is talking along the same line, but a little bit more, policy-based in an effort to pick up the economy through solving inherent financial problems as opposed to pouring money in it. On the other hand, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, she is adamantly against spending money and insists that the problem of the economy, the world economy, cannot be solved in a short meeting in London.
And probably if Afghanistan were taken off the table, I doubt very much that contributes to Europeans and the Asian market's sense of confidence in America, when we're pouring money into an unwinnable situation. Have there been any noises from Iran that you've heard of? What is Iran saying about all this? Iran is at the summit.
Iran has been pretty quiet, and I don't expect them to really go one way or another. They have enough policy and relationship issues to work out with these Western countries on other topics than the economy, and I think they'll be happy to take any sort of economic boost that the G20 proposes on a global standard. I think Iran will take anything they can get as a side effect rather than voice up and really request something.
Thank you so much for that. That was, of course, KBOO's reporter Spencer Raymond joining us, as he does every weekday morning with DC Dirt. Thank you so much for that, Spencer.
Thanks, Chris.
French President Sarkozy announced yesterday that he threatened to wreck the London summit if France's demands for tougher financial regulation aren't met. France will not accept a G20 deal that produces a, quote, a false success with language that sounds good but contains no commitments, unquote. The French threat dramatically raised the temperature hours before President Obama arrived in London. If carried through, it would ruin a summit for which British PM Gordon Brown and President Obama have high ambitions, believing it vital to the international recovery.
The University of East London suspended a professor for inciting criminal action at this week's G20 summit. Professor Chris Knight, an expert in anthropology at the university for 20 years, was suspended for inciting criminal action in a newspaper interview he gave last week. Now the university has cancelled plans to host an alternative G20 summit and is to close its doors for the duration of the talks because the university fears that it has become linked to direct action protests.
Finally this, Rick Wagner will leave his post as CEO of bailed out General Motors with a $20 million retirement package. The Treasury Department barred GM from paying severance to Wagner or any other senior executive, but Wagner is eligible to collect millions in retirement benefits from his former employee. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Tuesday, March 31st, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Kate Welch. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. Happy birthday, Kathleen. And I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. The guest will be Marjorie Cohen, president of the National Lawyers Guild, and she'll talk about the Spanish judge's charges of war crimes against Bush administration officials.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the... dragging themselves through the naked Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedies among the scholars of war, who were expelled from the academies for crazy and publishing obscene odes on the windows of the skull, who cowered in unshaven rooms and underwear, burning their money in wastebaskets and listening to the terror through the night. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow.
Flashpoints, a Spanish judge targets members of the Bush administration for possible war crimes. Also, Obama calls for a major escalation of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. in Berkeley. I am Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. You may have heard a Spanish court has agreed to consider charging six former members of the Bush administration on alleged torture charges, war crimes charges at Guantanamo, among other places. And we have been following this story for some time. So has our first guest, Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie Cohen is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, most recently the author to Soon to Be, or is it out now? Yes?
It will be out in mid-April, mid to late April.
36 seconds. Rules of Disengagement, the Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Marjorie Cohen, you have written also about all the potential crimes and war crimes and sort of violations of law, national and international, by the Bush administration. What is your response and what is the significance of the Spanish judge sort of, if you will, threatening to Pinochet members of the Bush administration?
Well, Spain is considering doing what the United States should be doing. When we ratified the Convention Against Torture, we agreed that we would prosecute and punish violations of the Convention Against Torture. And there have been recent admissions by members of the Bush administration, former members of the Bush administration, to torture, to waterboarding, etc. And waterboarding, as we know, has long constituted torture under U.S. law. Torture is a war crime and is punishable under the federal statute called the War Crimes Act. Now, Judge Garzón, referred the case to a Spanish prosecutor to determine whether or not to proceed with prosecutions against these six people, and I'll tell you who they are. John Yu, and your listeners know him well. He is a local up there before he went to Orange County, I think, to escape all of the attention he was getting in Berkeley, but he is a law professor at Berkeley Law School. William Haynes, who is working for Chevron now and used to be the Vice Presidential, the Department of Defense General Counsel. David Addington, who was Cheney's Chief of Staff. Alberto Gonzalez, of course, was the Attorney General and White House Counsel. Jay Bybee was the Assistant Attorney General during the Bush administration and is now a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And former Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith. They were members of the so-called War Council, and of course there were many others who have not been or are not under investigation in Spain, as we know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Ashcroft, Tenet, etc. So Judge Garzón referred this case to the Spanish prosecutor under Spain's universal jurisdiction law. And I think we've talked about universal jurisdiction before, but just to refresh people's recollections, many countries, including the United States, have these universal jurisdiction laws, and they allow a country to prosecute a foreign national, even if there's no direct relationship with the prosecuting country, because certain crimes are considered so heinous, they're crimes against all of humanity, and any country can punish them. Now, universal jurisdiction does not come into play if the country that the national is a national of is doing its job. So if the United States were launching an investigation against these former officials of the Bush administration, then countries like Spain wouldn't have to investigate them. Now, an interesting note is that Spain has been investigating charges of torture against Israel in Gaza, and as a result, the Spanish legislature is considering the repeal of Spain's universal jurisdiction law. Ironically, Israel used universal jurisdiction to try, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct relationship with Israel. There were some attempts during the Bush administration to bring some of the officials of the Bush administration to justice, such as Belgium, which initiated proceedings against Rumsfeld. The Bush administration threatened Belgium, said we're going to pull the headquarters of NATO out of Brussels if you don't drop these charges, and Belgium capitulated and dropped the charges. And there was a short period of time where Rumsfeld couldn't travel abroad for fear he would be arrested. Also, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, other groups asked the German federal prosecutor to investigate Rumsfeld and other Bush officials, but with some variable pressure from the Bush administration, the German federal prosecutor said no. So the question is, what will happen if arrest warrants issue, if the Spanish prosecutor takes the case and issues arrest warrants, if the legislature doesn't first dilute Spain's universal jurisdiction law so that it won't be used against Israel. And if arrest warrants do issue, then Spain or any of the 24 nations that participate in the European Extradition Convention would have to could arrest any of these six people if they traveled abroad and came to any of these countries in Europe. The question is going to be what Obama does. Well, Obama certainly will not extradite these people to Spain. The question is whether he will interfere with these prosecutions the way Bush interfered with prosecutions during the Bush administration. Will the Obama administration threaten Spain, for example, or threaten these other countries? And then the other question is, I think it is inevitable, as these torture memos come out, and some are imminent, some of the worst are going to be released soon, evidently, and as these congressional commissions develop this testimony, I think it's the tip of the iceberg, what we've seen so far. I don't think Obama and Eric Holder are going to have any choice but to proceed with investigation and prosecutions. Obama would reportedly like to hold off until the end of his first term, the beginning of his second term, so he can take care of the economy and Afghanistan and all of the other things on his plate. But he may not be able to wait that long. So it's a very, very positive development, and I think we're going to see more of this. I think that as...
Let me just jump in here for a second, because I want to talk just a little bit about how an investigation, Marjorie Cohen, like this would proceed. This judge appoints an investigator. Does this investigator begin to subpoena? Do these investigators, are they allowed to make visits to, say, the United States to pursue information? How does an investigation like this unfold?
Well, it's interesting, and there hasn't been a lot of precedent, although I have to say that the United States recently prosecuted and sentenced, a federal court in Miami sentenced Chucky Taylor, the son of the former Liberian president, to 97 years in federal prison for torture, even though the crimes were committed in Liberia. And we did that under the United States Universal Jurisdiction Law. And in that sense, the federal court had jurisdiction over Chucky Taylor and proceeded as we do with investigations and witness interviews and documents. It's a little trickier when you don't have jurisdiction over the people, but there's so much in the media. There are books like Mein Cowboy Republic, which make the case. There are the torture memos and other documents that are out there in the public realm. And there will invariably be, if this lawsuit or this complaint proceeds, witness interviews and further investigation. Let me just say that the court documents say, and this is in Spain, that without the legal advice from these legal eagles, such as you and Bybee and Addington and Haynes, it would have been impossible to structure a legal framework that supported what happened at Guantanamo. And the lawsuit claims, and this is what it claims, that these six former officials of the Bush administration, quote, participated actively and decisively in the creation, approval, and execution of a judicial framework that allowed for the deprivation of fundamental rights of a large number of prisoners, the implementation of new interrogation techniques, including torture, the legal cover for the treatment of those prisoners, the protection of the people who participated in illegal tortures, and above all, the establishment of impunity for all the government workers, military personnel, doctors, and others who participated in the detention center at Guantanamo, unquote. And the key word there, Dennis, is impunity. This is a word that is used in international human rights law to signify a situation where people get away with the most heinous crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. And the most important thing is that these people not get away with torture, with murder, because that would be impunity, and that's why Spain is proceeding the way it is.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Marjorie Cohn about a decision by a Spanish court. Criminal proceedings have, in fact, begun in Spain against six senior officials of the Bush administration. Again, to restate, we're talking about Alberto Gonzalez. He's a former White House counsel and Attorney General David Addington, former Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, Douglas Fife, who was the Undersecretary of Defense, William Haynes, formerly the Pentagon's general counsel, and John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who were both senior Justice Department legal advisors. They're all now under investigation by this international court. And again, just very...
No, this is Spanish court.
I'm sorry. I meant what I was... My question is, in this how does this Spanish court derive its power in the context of international law?
Well, Spain has ratified the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, and other treaties that outlaw torture, just the way the United States has. And, for example, we have what's called the Supremacy Clause in our Constitution, which says that treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. And that means that when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law, and therefore people can be held liable for violations of that torture convention. Now, what the United States did was to enact, the legislature enacted the torture statute to implement our obligations under the Convention Against Torture, under the treaty. And the war crimes statute provides for life imprisonment or even the death penalty for people who torture or participate in authorizing torture. And the death penalty would lie if the victim died. Now, it's not surprising that no one has been prosecuted yet under the torture statute. We also have the War Crimes Act, which specifies torture is a war crime. Nobody's been prosecuted under the War Crimes Act either. And so we really need to put pressure on the administration to use the laws that are on the books. There are these laws. There are federal laws against maiming, assault, stalking, and one of the interesting things, one of the torture memos, and I shouldn't say interesting, I should say alarming things about one of the torture memos that was written by John Yoo, is that he said that he was going to recommend that the Department of Justice not enforce these federal statutes against torture, maiming, assault, and stalking. The federal maiming statute is really quite something. It prohibits someone from cutting, slitting, or biting the lip or other member of the body, or pouring caustic acid over a person. And then these were the kinds of things that John Yoo said, hey, if that happens, we're not going to prosecute, all's fair in this so-called war on terror. So there's some pretty serious things that went on during the Bush administration. And as Obama said, nobody's above the law. We are a nation of laws, and whether it's politically feasible or not for him and his attorney general to proceed with investigations of these Bush officials, it needs to be done, because we are a nation of laws, and other countries look and see that we're not taking care of business, and it creates even more animosity against us. Some military officials recently said that the two leading recruitment factors for terrorists were Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And so this has actually, the Bush policy has actually made us less safe under the guise of making us more safe.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with Marjorie Cohn. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She teaches law at Thomas Jefferson down south in California. She is the author of the soon-to-be-released Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent, and has written books and lots of articles about the various potential war crimes and crimes against humanity of the Bush administration. Okay, Marjorie, I want to get you to respond to a couple of the responses to these investigations. Here's Obama saying, I guess he said this in January, when asked about if there would be an investigation. Obviously, I'm quoting him, we're going to be looking at past practices, and I don't believe that anybody is above the law, but my orientation's going to be to move forward. He says, we've got to move forward. Can you move forward and bury this kind of truth?
No, Dennis, you can't move forward without looking backward, because if we move forward without taking care of business, without taking care of what happened in the past, then history will repeat itself, and there will be other well-meaning leaders of the United States that will engage in the same kind of behavior because they'll know that they will not be brought to justice. Obama does not want to alienate the Republicans. Of course, they're alienated already, no matter what he does anyway. But he wants this bipartisanship. He wants to be perceived as a uniter, not a divider, and he would just prefer that we move forward and not bring anyone to justice. He doesn't want it to be perceived as a witch hunt. This is not a witch hunt where you pursue independent investigations of lawbreaking. And interestingly, Michael Mukasey, you'll recall he was Bush's third attorney general, said he didn't think there was any liability because these people were acting in good faith because they thought that they were protecting the country. Now, the good faith defense just doesn't fly, and Michael Mukasey should know better. He was a federal judge for many years. I have been a criminal defense attorney, and I can't imagine what would happen. Well, I know what would happen if I walked into court with my client who was charged with robbery and said, my client robbed that bank because it was supporting genocide in Darfur, and he acted in good faith because he wanted to stop the genocide. They would probably laugh me out of court. So this good faith defense it just won't cut it. And also, another defense is that, well, we were just relying on the advice of our lawyers. Michael Isikoff of Newsweek said that there are emails between the White House and these lawyers, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, David Addington, William Haynes, and we don't know what they say, and we don't know if they will ultimately be made public. But that could be the smoking gun, where you have people like Cheney, and Seymour Hersh said some interesting things about how powerful Cheney is today on Terry Gross and also in his recent New Yorker piece. But Cheney Colin Powell's former right-hand man, Lawrence Wilkerson, said that the torture emanated from the vice president's office. So if there are emails from Cheney's office through Addington, David Addington, who is widely believed to be the chief architect of this program where these lawyers were justifying basically torture and other war crimes, if you have emails where Cheney's office says, give us the legal backing or give us some legal arguments to enable us to commit these to torture, then that's the smoking gun. And of course, there are already a number of smoking guns. Cheney admitted he authorized waterboarding. There were several people who met in the basement of the White House and authorized waterboarding. John Yoo wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal recently saying that there was waterboarding that went on and it was perfectly fine. But it's not just waterboarding. There are many, many other techniques, not just torture, but also cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which also violate our treaty obligations.
Well, we're running out of time, but if you were a lawyer for one of these guys, defending one of these guys, because somebody's going to have to defend them if they end up in court, would you tell them now in preparation not to bother, say, traveling to certain places in the world?
Yes. I mean, if this goes forward, and there haven't been arrest warrants issued yet in Spain, but if and when there are, they're going to have trouble traveling to not just Spain, but several other European countries that have extradition agreements with Spain. They're going to have to watch it because they could travel to another country and be arrested. So, yes, I certainly would.
Is Pinochet the president? I'm sorry. Is Pinochet? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to say that you wouldn't really be?
I would not represent them.
Sorry.
I would prosecute them. And I can't imagine ever prosecuting anyone because I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years. But these people I would prosecute. In fact, I wrote an indictment against Alberto Gonzalez once. It's called the Gonzalez indictment. And it was quite an exercise for me who had been a criminal defense attorney for so long. But I quite enjoyed it, actually.
Okay. And in the final minute, Is the arrest of Augusto Pinochet, who was arrested in Great Britain, pursued, investigated, and indicted by the same Spanish judge, is this in any way a precedent?
Yes, that is that. Well, he didn't ultimately get tried for various reasons, but he certainly was arrested under universal jurisdiction. And this judge, Baltasar Garzon in Spain, was very involved in that prosecution. So, yes, there have been instances of prosecution. As I said, Adolf Eichmann recently in the United States, Chucky Taylor, and there have been other instances as well. It's a very well-established doctrine, and we're going to see more countries jumping on the bandwagon and investigating and hopefully prosecuting some of these Bush officials. And hopefully Obama will do his job and Eric Holder as well and bring them to justice.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, thank you for all your great work on this front. I want to tell people again, President of the National Lawyers Guild, and the book is coming up, is Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. People want to look for that, and we will look for you as this story unfolds. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In one moment, we'll be speaking about the expanding, the escalating war in Afghanistan. This one's going to be Obama's war. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now turn our attention to the very serious situation, the escalation of the war in Afghanistan, Obama's war. He seems to want this war bad. He's ready to dive in and give us a chance to see, I guess, what it's like to be in the middle of Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Taliban, the ISI, and a nuclear power that is facing off with another nuclear power, as in Pakistan and India. This is a profound situation. Ray McGovern, you have an article came out today in consortiumnews.com. You are very concerned, but you don't seem to be surprised.
Well, I'm disappointed. I had expected better of the new president. It's one thing to say, as is reasonable to say, that he's been totally preoccupied with the financial meltdown. But the other part of it is that he has not assembled anything in the way of an objective, new, fresh look at the situation in Afghanistan and, more important, far, far more important, Pakistan. Just to kind of take a step back here, most people know that 2,500 years ago, Alexander the Great tried to get through Afghanistan on his way to China. He got whittled down, or his troops did, by these, quote, militants, end quote, who even then were sort of had this weird view that they didn't like outsiders coming in and occupying their country. Anyhow, that was 2,500 2,500 years ago, what Alexander did and what made him great, in my opinion, was that he looked at all this, and then he looked at those mountains, and he said, you know, I think I'm going to change my mind here. It doesn't seem like it's worth it, and I might even get to China. And he turned around and went back to Europe like a sensible person would. Now, since then, we've had the Indians, we've had the Persians, we've had the Mongolians, we've had the British, we've had the Russians, and now we're going to, quote, prevail in Afghanistan. Give me a break. It's not going to work, okay? And then I thought, well, at least, he'll gather some sensible advisors that will tell him that, and also will tell him, you know, what really is driving the insurgency. And all he has to do is look at Jessica Tuchman Matthews, the head of the president of the Carnegie Foundation, and, you know, she says precisely what's happening here. It's the it's the presence of foreign troops that's driving the insurgency. So, you know, it's sort of like a no-brainer, and yet Obama, for some reason, feels he has to be has to let himself be railroaded into a commitment of troops designed, no doubt, to prevent a very early collapse of what's already there in Afghanistan, but doesn't seem to realize that this is where you get sucked into the kind of situation that another young president by the name of John Kennedy faced when he first came in, and the name of that one is Vietnam, and this to me looks like it's very, very likely to become Obama's Vietnam.
All right. It really is extraordinary, and we have to admit it, and we have to say it out loud now. This was the peace president. He ran first and foremost on a platform of peace. Bring those troops home.
Yeah, Dennis, that was only half of it, though, you know. Bring some of them home, but send others to...
Yeah, we heard more and more as he got... The closer he got to be the president, the more we heard about the second part of that plan.
Yeah. And that always struck me as campaign rhetoric. I mean, if you're going to be if you're going to look like a wuss on Iraq, then you have to look really strong in Afghanistan, right? Well, it turned out not to be just campaign rhetoric. Either he's feeling irresistible pressure from the... let's say it, the military-industrial congressional complex, or he really feels that this is necessary, at least, and that he can control it. And that's the, you know, that's the real tragic flaw here. Once you start down this road, you're not able to control it. What you need to do is talk to these people, just as he's promised to talk to the Iranians, is to talk, get this thing tamped down, not send more troops, because, as I said before, and as the Carnegie Endowments and many others who have their heads screwed on right realize, it is, in fact, that the additional troops, it is, in fact, the occupiers that are driving the Taliban and, you know, increasing their numbers, as I heard you say to Marjorie Cohn, you know, or Marjorie said, you know, the biggest effect of this counterinsurgency cum torture regime is that the lines for al-Qaeda recruiting stations and other terrorist organizations had never been so long. They have no trouble at all recruiting jihadists to avenge what's going on. So, you know, it's a real, real dilemma. And one of the real problems here, Dennis, is that there's no evidence at all that the intelligence community was asked to do the estimate. In other words, before you do a major policy change like this, it's de rigueur, you know, to order a national intelligence estimate with the title something like Expected Taliban-Pakistani Reaction to This U.S. Course of Action, okay? It's heavily classified, but the title is anodyne like that. So we're going to put in, 21,000 troops. What's going to happen? Well, there's no indication that I have, matter of fact, I have contrary indications, no indication that the intelligence community was asked to pronounce on this, and that is inexcusable. Inexcusable, because the president is entitled to an objective assessment of what the likely reaction will be and what the costs will be over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And he doesn't have that. What he has is Petraeus. You know, I call him Petraeus ex machina. I sort of play on words. The deus ex machina of the situation here. He and Gates have done their own little policy review. And they invite, you know, they co-opt one or two intelligence community analysts, and they sort of say, well, you know, the intelligence community has had an input here, but they have not. And that's precisely, you know, be a little bit on a tangent here, that's precisely why the Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, wanted very much to have a gutsy guy like Chas Freeman take over these responsibilities as head of the National Intelligence Council. And, of course, the Likud lobby put the kibosh on that. And that is a great loss, frankly. It's a great loss to our country. So, bottom line, Obama has been deprived of an objective assessment of what will happen if he puts these troops in. And that's very different from this experience that I went through in Vietnam. At each stage, before LBJ decided to send the next 200,000 troops in, we were asked to do an assessment of, you know, would this make Ho Chi Minh cave? Would it stop the supply of troops, materiel and North Vietnamese troops to the south? In both cases, we said, hell no, Mr. President. Now, he decided to go ahead anyway because he didn't want to be the first president to lose, first U.S. president to lose a war. But at least, he had the presence of mind to find out what we really thought. And he followed his own instincts, which turned out to be really bad. But the intelligence community had an input into that. In this case, it's not clear. And Obama, when he made his little speech, you know, he paid tribute to all these military and diplomatic and all these other inputs. He never once mentioned an input from the intelligence community. So that's really worrisome because...
You know, let's just do a little parallel invention here of our own Ray McGovern, and let's just say he was dealing with the financial situation, and he thought the best thing to do, looking at the situation, was to bring in, say, the head of Chrysler and General Motors and Bernie Madoff. Because they did such a good job, right? I mean, honestly, he's taken the same crew.
Yeah.
And they're doing it again. And he's standing in these rooms with all these advisors, and it's cognitive dissonance, as you write, correct?
Yeah. It is. It's really quite amazing. And those of us who have been through the Vietnam experience so see such distinct parallels that it's all the more disquieting. He needs to, you know, what he said, you know, when he started appointing people like Robert Gates to continue as the defense secretary, what he said was, look, you know, I'm going to be doing the policy here. You know, don't worry about these people. He's got experience. He might not agree with him, but I'm going to be making the policy. Well, you know, maybe, you know, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt here. Maybe this is simply a reflection of the fact that he's been told, look, if you don't put, 15,000, 17,000, I guess is the number, troops in there right away, it's going to be bedlam, and they're going to be flying what's left of the U.S. presence out in helicopters. Will be really bad. So put them in for a while, and then let's see if we can work something out. But, you know, this notion of 5,000 more or 4,000 more to be training the Afghans, well, you know, the Afghans are not a country. The Afghans are a bunch of tribes. So which tribes do you train? You know, it shows a complete ignorance of the... on the ground situation in Afghanistan. And as I said, as I started to say before, Pakistan is the real problem here. And, you know, if you towed up, just to give a kind of a balance of perspective here, if you towed up population figures alone, Pakistan has 172 million people in it, okay? Now, if you take Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq together, you get 50 million less than exist in Pakistan. As you already mentioned, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, about 100 of them. So does India. You know, the prospect of what we're doing, and it's likely to have this effect, the prospect of what we're doing leading to the fall of the democratically structured, at least, if not in fact operating, democratic government in Pakistan fall to a bunch of people who you can't be trusted to be careful about using nuclear weapons, that is a nightmare. And what we're doing, bombing parts of Pakistan, raiding border villages and that kind of thing, what we're doing is going to have exactly that effect unless we stop it. And, you know, one interesting thing, Dennis, if you watch the speech there on Friday, Obama was supposed to go on at 20 minutes after 9, our time, Eastern time, so that would have been real early your time, 20 after 6, I guess. Well, he didn't show, and he didn't show, and all these cable things, you know, all they're showing is the podium, and they're trying to make inane conversation about what he might say and all this stuff. Half hour he didn't show. And so I'm thinking, you know, what's going on there? You know, he's got all these guys. Do they have to push him through the door? I mean, you know, what happened? What happened in the hours before? Well, I'll tell you what happened. A soldier in the Afghan army shot dead two U.S. troops, wounded a third before killing himself. 10 Afghan police were killed that morning by Taliban. 7 more were wounded by an ambush Taliban. Last, but by no means least, just hours before the president went on, a suicide bomber in the Afghan border area near the Khyber Pass, okay, where a lot of the Pakistani police patrol people worship. What did he do? The suicide bomber bombed the mosque, packed with hundreds of worshipers. They were attending Friday prayers, of course. He killed 50 right off the bat. I don't know what the result is now. Well, you know, I have the notion Obama's getting all these reports. You know, this was my job at one point. I used to update presidents before they did these things. And he's saying, you know, do I really want to do this? Am I just about to do something really dumb? You know, this is all speculation, and it's very circumspect.
Well, Ray, we only have a minute or two left, but let's also not forget the ISI, the Pakistani sort of version of the CIA, really created in part by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. You know a lot about this. Was it shocking to you that the ISI is working hand in hand with the Taliban? They say because you really need to know the enemy to deal with them.
Well, the ISI, with Bill Casey's patronage from the CIA, set up the Taliban, okay? And they find the Taliban very useful because Pakistan's strategic priority is India, okay? And that having the Taliban in Afghanistan is a really good thing for the PACs, as they look at it as a counterweight to Indian influence there. And to the degree they feel that way, and to the degree they still act that way by supporting the Taliban, giving them arms and giving them intelligence that we give the PACs, I mean, it's a very, very delicate situation. And that's what the Pakistan intelligence service is doing. We know that that's what they're doing, and yet we're getting deeper and deeper into this quagmire. It's really very dangerous.
All right, we're giving you 90 seconds to advise the president. Listen, Mr. President, here's Ray McGovern.
Mr. President, you should make a speech about Afghanistan very different from the one you gave on Friday. You should make it clear that you're sending the additional 17,000 troops simply to prevent the fall of Kabul and other places with population concentrations, and that you are initiating a call for negotiations without preconditions with the Taliban factions, with the Pakistanis, with the rest of the Afghan government, and with Iran, and with anybody else in the area, Russians, Chinese, to deal with this problem and get the situation back under control. That you do not intend to escalate this the way Vietnam was escalated. You will get a good response to that. It may take a little while, but that's the best way to go under these circumstances.
All right. Ray McGovern, his article, recent article on consortiumnews.com, Welcome to Vietnam. Mr. President, Ray McGovern is on with us many times. He works with Tell the World, the publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. And in the 60s, he served as an infantry intelligence officer and then became a CIA analyst. Ray McGovern, thanks for being with us.
You're most welcome, Dennis.
You take it easy now. Thank you.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
KBOO is proud to host A Conversation with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, on Saturday, April 11th at the Baghdad Theater. This event is a benefit for KBOO Community Radio. KBOO's own Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza, hosts of Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, will interview Amy on stage. She will talk about her book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, and her experiences as an award-winning journalist. That's A Conversation with Amy Goodman benefit for KBOO on April 11th at noon at the Baghdad Theater in Southeast Portland. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm or by phone at 503-231-8032.
Yes, it's true. Democracy Now!, the award-winning daily news program with Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, can now be heard twice a day on KBOO. Hear Democracy Now! First at 7 a.m. and then again at 4 p.m. Monday through Friday on KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party features DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KBOO Celeste Carey, and the MRG Foundation / KBOO Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
And coming up at 11, which is just a minute and a half away, 2 minutes away, 1 minute away, stage and studio, we're going to hear about Tears of Joy Theater's production of This Fabulous Bear. Also, art historian W.J.T. Mitchell talks about the impact of imagery on the psyche. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews local artist Chris Haberman about his upcoming shows. This is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Stage and Studio. I'm Dimae Roberts. Polish puppet master created a mischievous little bear in 1960, much to the delight of children around the world. Tears of Joy Theater brings this fabulous bear to Northwest audiences and to Stage and Studio today. I'm looking at some puppets right now, and they're getting ready to perform, and we're going to hear all about that on today's show, and hopefully you'll get to see it online as well. And in the second part of the show, we'll hear about the impact of the visual imagery on the American psyche. KBOO's Frank Reynolds talked with noted art historian W.J.T. Mitchell, who's giving a talk tomorrow night at Pacific Northwest College of Art. Plus a ticket giveaway, so stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. With me in the studio are Chris Woolen. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
And Jonathan Owicki. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Hannah Long.
Good morning.
Welcome all to Stage and Studio. And you're all from the Tears of Joy Puppet Theater's production of Fabulous Bear. And for our listeners, I can see the puppets here. So we have to pretend like, you know, you can't see them either and describe them to us, for us. So let's have you each introduce the characters you're playing and the puppets you brought with you. Let's start with Chris.
Well, I am the fabulous bear Rim Chim Chee, and he is a small teddy bear with sparkly eyes and a hand-knitted sweater made in Poland. And he sounds like this.
Hi, my name is Timothy Rim Chim Chee.
Oh, he's delightful. He doesn't have to wake you up in the morning, that's for sure. He's so cute. And so Timothy is the lead, right, of the Timothy Bear?
Yes, I am the lead. I am the diva in this show.
I mean, he looks like he's been, you know, working quite a bit here, you know?
Well, I was actually 30 years old when I came to Tears of Joy in 1990.
Oh, wow. You look good for your age.
Well, thank you. I've been recently refurbished by Janet Bradley, our managing director, and everything else.
Well, Timothy, you brought some friends with you. Would you like to introduce them?
Yes, I would love to introduce my puppy, my friend Ruff.
Hey,
Ruff. Ruff. And his puppeteer, Hannah.
Well, Hannah, what does Ruff look like?
Ruff is a scruffy little dog. He is gray and shaggy, and he is a stray, so he looks like he could use some love, but he's very lovable.
I mean, he looks like a real puppy.
Yeah,
he really does. He's got the big, long ears, and, you know, he's just very lovable.
They flop very nicely, and he's got a great tail.
And so who else is with us today?
Well, let's see. Right now, I'm holding the fox, who is actually the villain of the whole piece, and he has a long snout that he can look around with. And actually, his arms are controlled by my hand is in a sleeve, so he is actually able to pick things up because his hand is actually just my hand in a glove.
Well, he's a lot bigger than
he's a lot
else.
Bigger. Yes, he is, and he actually is a burglar who sneaks into Timothy's house to try to steal things.
And Ruff protects Timothy.
Ruff protects Timothy. Yep.
So, how bad of a villain is he?
Oh, he's. I think he's just misunderstood, really. No, he's definitely a baddie, but
just trying to get by.
He's just trying to get by. It's a hard time, yeah.
He's definitely been hit hard by the economic crisis.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, and we'll talk about that definitely. Well, so you're all doing this really great production. It's Fabulous Bear. It was first introduced in Poland in 1960, and everyone around the world just started falling in love with Fabulous Bear. So tell us about Fabulous Bear and what makes this production, you know, and him so lovable.
Well, I think what makes him so lovable to me is Jan Wilkowski, the Polish director who brought him. Tears of Joy Theater commissioned Wilkowski to bring Aladdin. And at the time, he said, I have this other show. It was made for television, but it is very, very popular with the young children. And I was a young, brand-new puppeteer at this time, and we actually rehearsed for 10 weeks with these puppets, and we were so proud of our work. And we went out on the road, and we discovered that it's really very much for young children. Most of Tears of Joy Theater's work out in the schools is for the K-6 age audience. And this plays to that preschool through third grade, and they love it. And I have a 4-year-old daughter, and she loves it.
It's a very sweet show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the plot? Tell us the plot.
Well, Timothy lives with only his father. It is not said in the script what's happened
to
his
mother. Oh, you've got Big Bear
yes,
here.
Yes, we have Papa Bear here,
We have Papa Bear here as well.
Who
sort of
Papa
talks
Bear.
Like this, and he's a very, very kind-hearted, if a bit confused sometimes as a father, and
He's just a very good natured, except he can get kind of grumbly because he has had a bad experience with dogs in the past when he lived in the forest, and that is one of the main sources of conflict.
Not with Ruff specifically,
but it colors their interactions.
You see, at the top of the show, we don't meet Ruff. We meet Ruff when Timothy is sent to the store to buy one egg. And actually, that's the scene that we brought for you, is when Timothy goes to the store and first meets the puppy.
So we're going to have a scene here. And so you just set it up perfectly.
Does that work for you?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
so
Timothy meeting the puppy for the first time.
Yeah, very first time.
And it's singing, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
I have to buy one egg I'm gonna buy. Only one egg I'm gonna buy. Not two, not three, rim-jam-gee. Not four, or. Only one egg you should know. In the store I will say, ah! A dog! Oh, it's a puppy! Oh! Nice puppy! Good puppy! Oh! but smelly. Hey, are you in a big hurry? I'll get you some bones later. But right now, I have to go to the store and buy one egg. You want to go with me? Oh, boy. Come on, puppy. Let's go. La, 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 la.
And off they go. Well, that was so much fun. You know, I really do wish our audience could see it, but you know, really, it's very delightful, and you really forget about the puppeteer, you know, when you're seeing the puppets in action.
And in this style, mostly you won't see the puppeteers unless you're up in the balcony.
Oh, so you have, you're
a playboard
underneath. Yeah.
There's a playboard that's 5 feet. It's all hidden rod puppetry. They, like I said, they were made originally for television. This is what sets up the show. He meets the puppy. He brings the puppy home, but Papa's had bad experience with dogs, so he can't keep the puppy. But then he decides to let him in that night because he'll just get in trouble tomorrow. And that night is the night.
Is when the fox comes and the fox breaks into their house.
Are we going to have a fox scene here?
We could do that.
Oh, I think we should. Okay.
So the fox sneaks up, and you see him with his flashlight, and you see his silhouette, and then you see his hands creep up, and then his face creep up, and he looks around, and he says,
they are sleeping. Have pleasant dreams, little bears. Oh, the bag? Sorry. Business is business. My big CEO bonus will not last me forever. The window, it is locked. The other window, it is locked as well. How is Fox supposed to make a living when everyone locks doors at night? Open. Super fantastic. Wendy, both bears sleep and snore. Wendy, both bears sleep and snore. They are very tired. Good sleep is required. So I won't knock on the door.
Well, thank you for that song.
Sure.
Our listeners might want to know that I was recording that with my little video camera here, so I'll be posting that online later on the Facebook page. You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts, being thoroughly charmed by Tears of Joy Puppet Theater, and we just had a little performance with puppets, and you'll have to go online later at kboo.fm to see them. And my guests are Chris Woolen and Jonathan Owicki and Hannah Long. And Fabulous Fair opens April 3rd, runs through April 19th. And I'm just wondering, how long, I know, Chris, you've been at this for a long, long time, but how long have all of you been puppeteers?
I have been doing this, I guess,
2 years. I started with Bread and Puppet, which is a political puppet theater out of Vermont. Some people might be familiar with them. I spent a summer at their farm and then toured with them in fall of 2007 and then came here to do this. And yeah.
I like how the puppy's wagging its tail.
I know. I mean, the puppy's been very attentive to me and responds every time I touch it and everything. Like, if I touch it, it starts panting. So, and how long, Jonathan, have you been?
I have been puppeteering for 2 years as well, although I started with Tears of Joy about 2 years ago. I had just graduated from college, and I had never picked up a puppet before, but I saw they had an audition notice for their touring puppeteers going to schools around the Northwest, and I thought I could do that. So,
were you both in theater before this, then?
I was. I got a BA in theater. So
I grew up doing some dancing in theater, and I feel like puppetry combines all of those visual interests and communications. And Jonathan and I are actually touring partners for it this year. So we've been touring a show called The Shoemaker and the Elves around Washington.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So, but this is fairly new for you. I mean, you know, in the comparable, you know, canon of your work. So this is sort of a new phase of it. Do you like it?
I love it. You know? It's an amazing combination of creative and technical brain aspects. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying to figure out not only how do I tell this story, how do I bring this character to life, but also how do I make it look like this puppet is actually picking up this prop or things like that. It's just using all different kinds of your brain and all of your muscles. And within one show,
you can be several different characters. Like, John is two different voices in this show.
I'm also a chicken.
That's right.
Chicken!
And also, it's fun. Like, something that I think should be mentioned is that the two puppets that Jonathan does are both hand puppets one of his hands is in the mouth and the other is out in a glove. And so sometimes I second him, and what that means is that I will come up and put one of my hands in the other glove, and so that the puppet has two hands. So it's kind of magical. It's like how Ernie works on Sesame Street and like a lot of things. So it's really neat to see, like, how does that work?
And it requires a special kind of psychic communication between puppeteers.
Which we have.
Yeah,
that's so great that you can do that. Well, Tears of Joy Puppet Theater presents Fabulous Bear. It opens Friday, April 3rd at 7:30 p.m. and continues Saturdays, April 4th and 11th and 18th at 11 a.m. and Sundays, April 5th, 12th, and 19th at 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. and closes Sunday, April 19th at 4 p.m. They're keeping you guys pretty busy, aren't they? You got a couple shows, like two a day sometimes, huh?
Sometimes, yeah.
Well, you know, it sounds like it's really fun to do. Everything's at the Winningstad Theater in Portland, at the Portland Center for the Performing Arts at 1111 Southwest Broadway. And tickets are $14 for children, $16 for adults. There is a service charge, I guess, and then, you know, when you're ordering tickets. So for more info, call 1-360-695-3050 if you live in Washington, or call in Portland at 503-248-0557. That's 248-0557. Or visit their website at totj.org for Tears of Joy Puppet Theater or something. What is it? Was it
TOJT?
I did something there. So TOJT.org. And also through their Ticketmaster.com, you can get tickets there. And we have a pair of tickets available for the third caller here at KBOO at 503-231-5106. That's 231-5106 for the third caller for Tears of Joy Puppet Theater. And you're also going to have some hands-on puppet theater activities, right? Or something during the show or after the show?
Our education director, Emily Alexander, who is also the director of this show, and she creates activities that we put out in the lobby. It's usually some kind of a simple puppet. And I think this time it's going to be a chick with an egg. Aww. There's a whole egg chick Well, you get sent to the store to buy eggs and the whole thing counting the eggs.
Oh, how cute.
So each time, before and after, out in the rotunda of the Portland Center for the Performing Arts, there will be tables with craft activities that the children can do with their parents or their grandparents or their aunts and uncles, or your inner child can make the activity with you. and then you have your own puppet to take home.
Well, that's so great that there are activities, and I think, you know, especially with, I think, puppet theater, you really get interactivity with the audience, with the mm-hmm. children especially. And I've noticed in going to past Tears of Joy shows that the kids just hang on, and they just stay after the show, and they really want to talk to the puppets.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they really, is that what you found out?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you'll try to talk to them, but they don't want to talk
to
them.
They don't want to talk to you.
No, no.
They don't want to talk to your hand.
Yeah.
No. To your puppet. I mean, and especially when you stay in character with Ruff here wagging his tail here. It's hard not to talk to the puppet. I know. You're in character, Hannah. That's wonderful.
That was actually my first real epiphany working for Tears of Joy Theater. I had a very stick-like puppet, and I went on tour, and we were interacting, and this little girl threw her arms around my puppet and gave it a huge kiss, and that's when I knew that this puppet was alive for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are very few places for children to go to and feel safe and loved like that. So, you know, obviously you're doing a great job. And I want to encourage our audience to check out Tears of Joy Theater, definitely, and see all the shows that you're doing, you know, and the rest of your season. Chris Wolin, Jonathan Owicki, and Hannah Long of Tears of Joy Puppet Theater, thank you so much for dropping by and bringing your friends today.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Now, again, if you want to see photos, and I'm going to actually have some video up later, of the puppets, visit kboo.fm/stageandstudio. And also, you can see the video actually on the Stage and Studio Facebook page. Next up, we have a noted art historian and image specialist, W.J.T. Mitchell, who talked to Frank Reynolds. So we'll be back right after this break. Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Now, when you work in radio, you feel like American society is becoming more and more reliant on visual images. A prominent scholar on the meaning of icons and images is coming to the Pacific Northwest College of Art tomorrow night. Professor W.J.T. Mitchell of the University of Chicago touches on wide-ranging subjects from dinosaurs to Spike Lee. KBOO's Frank Reynolds talk with W.J.T. Mitchell about the meaning of visual culture and how images and visual representations create the world we inhabit.
Well, it occurs in many different ways, simultaneously, through television, most obviously, cinema, iconic photographs of important historical events, and then the perceptions of everyday life. It's not just the media, but also the immediate circumstances of everyday encounters. New people moving into your neighborhood, participating in mass spectacles, for instance, the year of presidential campaigning in this country, much of which involved human beings gathered in unprecedented numbers in mass gatherings. So all of these things, I think, together produce a visual culture, which is specific sometimes to a country, but can also have international impacts, as we saw when Barack Obama arrived in Berlin it immediately recalled the great spectacle of Jack Kennedy going to Berlin back in the 60s.
And much of your work deals with the very concept of the image, because images can move from one medium to another, as, for example, a still picture can be animated, or a description in a book can be recast in sculpture. You argue that images make up a kind of meta-medium that cannot be contained within any specific material incarnation. Could you explain this idea?
I think it's an idea that is, in one sense, very old. That is, it's part of the fundamental ontology of images, that they can move from one medium to another, so that the image in a painting, say a Renaissance painting, almost invariably comes from some text. So it had to cross a border between language and vision, and part of recognizing what a picture is about, looking at it and saying, oh, that's a crucifixion, or that's the parting of the Red Sea, or any other historical event. Part of that is recognizing that a translation has occurred from one medium to another, that you know the scene from language, and now you see it in a visual form, or vice versa. This can happen the other way as well, that a visual image then acquires a name, a description, a narrative, and produces a translation. So I think it's a fundamental feature of images that they move from one medium to another. And this has become hyper-evident in our time with the computer, which is a kind of master medium also, and allows us to transfer data of all kinds from one platform to another, turning sounds into sights or language into image. The computer has made something that's very old evident in a new way.
So what role do images such as stereotypes play in social and political contexts?
Well, they play an absolutely essential role. I know stereotypes have a bad reputation. People say, oh, you shouldn't stereotype people. But I think it's important to recognize that we couldn't function in the world without stereotypes. And stereotypes are ways of making extremely primitive and simple differentiations. Differentiations of gender, race, class, social status. So, you know, ordinary social life is very much built upon a whole repertoire of stereotypes we carry around.
So your upcoming talk is titled The Future of the Image. Can you tell me a little about that?
The talk is looking at several different things. One is I'm doing a kind of comparison of my approach to images with that of a prominent French philosopher named Jacques Rancière, who has written a book called The Future of the Image. So looking at the ways we approach the relation of images to works of art, the relation of images to language, and the relation of images to politics particularly. So that's one part of it. Another aspect is to look at something that Rancière declines to do. He says he doesn't want to deal with the long history of the image from the caves of Lascaux to the present twilight of digital and virtual images. So one of the things I decided to do in my account of the future of the image was to try to characterize that long panorama. You know, how could we think of the phenomenon of the image from the earliest instances we know about, let's say the paintings in the caves of Lascaux, right down to the contemporary phenomenon of the digital image? What would we find if we tried to look at that as one long panorama, an odyssey? And to simplify it a bit, I'm focusing mainly on the figure of the animal in the history of imagery. And so part of the paper is, why look at animals? Why is the animal icon so important for thinking about the history of human involvement in images? And so the paper will deal with that as well.
And that was W.J.T. Mitchell, art historian and image theorist, speaking with KBOO's Frank Reynolds. You can hear Mitchell talk more about art and the future of the image tomorrow, April 1st at 6:30 at PNCA's Schweigert Commons. For more information about this free talk, visit pnca.edu. And a couple of announcements before we go. A friend of mine and a mainstay of public radio training is coming to town this week and doing a couple of shows of her stand-up comedy. She recently did some training with KBOO, and I highly recommend seeing her. She's amazingly funny and satiric and has a very sharp wit. San Francisco comic Marilyn Pittman, she takes on road rage, NPR, gay marriage, personal ads, and the news media, and she's doing two shows, April 4th, Saturday at 10:30 p.m., and Sunday, April 5th at 7 p.m. at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, the IFCC. Also with her on hand will be comic Gail Hand, and that's two shows only, and you can get more information about it at marilynpittman.com. Also, you can call you can log on to ifccarts.org, and the PDX box office is open from 1 to 9 p.m. at 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. More info, 503-205-0715. That's 205-0715. It's $20 for general admission and $18 for seniors and students with ID. And if you want to check out The Coast sometime, there's a great series for writers. It's the Willamette Writers Coast Branch, and it's called Writers on Writing Workshops. And Barbara Drake, a prominent writer, will be there at the Newport Public Library. And so if you want to check out more of their series, actually, you can go on to the Willamette Writers website or check out the Newport Public Library and Sylvia Beach Hotel, and check that out online as well at willamettewriters.com. That's it for Stage and Studio this week. Our engineer is Kate Welch. Thank you, Kate. And if you missed any of this show, you can listen online starting tomorrow at kboo.fm/stageandstudio, and also join our Stage and Studio Facebook page. Next week, we feature Passon Art Theater and Artist Repertory Theater. So till then, I'm Dee May Roberts. Stay tuned for Art Focus with Ava Lake.
KBOO is proud to host A Conversation with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, on Saturday, April 11th at the Baghdad Theater. This event is a benefit for KBOO Community Radio. KBOO's own Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza, hosts of Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, will interview Amy on stage. She will talk about her book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, and her experiences as an award-winning journalist. That's A Conversation with Amy Goodman benefit for KBOO on April 11th at noon at the Baghdad Theater in Southeast Portland. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm or by phone at 503-231-8032.
Hey there, my name is Ava Lake, and you're listening to Art Focus. Thanks for joining us this morning. Also, thanks for following us to our new time slot. We've been here about a month now. If you've missed any of our past shows, or you want to hear just some of the past interviews, I've been uploading them all on a new homepage. kboo.fm/artfocus. So when you go to that page, you can see images, you can see links to galleries and to the artist's website, and I've been uploading just about every interview that I've done since I've been on Art Focus. My guest today is someone that I think the first time I met him was outside of art media, and he had a big lineup of paintings that were out on the street. Is that true, Chris Haberman?
Yep, that's true. That's very true.
Now, okay, so Chris Haberman, he's an artist. He shows all over town, and he's also a curator. Correct me if I'm mistaken, you curate Olympic Mills, yes?
Correct.
Are you curating anywhere else right now?
I have the East Bank Commerce Center, too, which is also owned by the same company, Beam. And okay. I have a handful of bars and restaurants, kind of where I started in Portland, showing art. So I've continued to help them out, to bring people in to have a place to show.
That is great. We're going to talk a little bit about curating and about your philosophy of mm-hmm. curating. But I think what I'd like to do, first of all, is talk to you as an artist and find out what you're doing. So I would like to just kind of start with when I first met you. You had these paintings out on the street. Had you been showing them in art media, or what was the deal there? It was this beautiful lineup right there on, like, 9th Avenue or whatever that was.
Yeah, just right outside of art media on the Max track. They, art media, they called me and asked me if I could. They were coming out with a new spray paint, this Montana spray paint, and so they were talking about having a demonstration live. So they just said, I'd met them through when I worked at the Portland Arts Center with Gavin Scheller, mm-hmm. so I just had a good connection with them, and we just put it all together. They helped set the thing up, and there was actually some controversy around it. We had, you know, it was graffiti artists, like, got graffiti and gallery people all together, and we did a big live demonstration outside of art media, which was really successful and had a lot of music, and people would get off the Max and come see it. It was a good event, a nice live paint.
And you brought people together, the people pro and con as far as graffiti goes.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, very much. Like, I had some people that were kind of on the edge and some people that were very established, you know, as far as showing art in other cities and things, but they still use spray paint as a medium. So it was a nice interaction. That's really, I love to make interactions between more of the, like, the fine artists and the street artists and bringing mm-hmm. people together and showing all people's work together. I think that's really important.
Where can we see your work online?
Or I'm redoing my website, but I'm okay. I'm on MySpace.com.
You've got MySpace? Yeah. Okay, so if it was...
Haberman Art, okay. MySpace.com.
All right. And also, you're going to be showing this month at Launchpad.
Correct, yep.
So I think they've got some of your work on their side, too. Maybe it's launchpad.org, I believe that's...
Yeah, the show's called People Will Talk.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that exhibition.
I've been working with... I've been wanting to, for like 4 years, work with a photographer and pretty much like... take a photographer's body of work, a good 20 plus paintings, and do paintings of each of their photos without any knowledge of what's going on in the photos. So I met a very personal photographer named Mark Wickham, who is, he doesn't really show a whole lot in Portland, but his work's very personal. And so we picked through.
What do you mean by personal? Like private stories?
Like private stories. He knows everyone in his photos for at least a year before he takes a picture of them. So, and they're large color fields, and there's always a one person subject. They're really interesting, and it's, you know, it's a pretty everything seems like a very private moment.
Kind of a psychological portrait.
Definitely, yeah. And I mean, I paint people primarily, you know, which was an accident when I started painting. But and I have a lot of words, and his stuff is devoid of language. But there's so much going on. I always felt like there was a subconscious element in his work. So I really wanted to explore that as a painter to interpret his work.
Well, so you approached this photographer and said, yes, I'd like to paint your photographs.
Yeah.
But you're doing your spin, as I understand. You are adding words and things like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And how does he feel about it?
He's pretty open to it. He liked the idea of the fact that I didn't know what was going on, or, you know, I'd get these photos in email and there's like one word for them and that's it, like maybe the person's real name. And that's it. And that's what his titles are. Everything's very concise in his work, and he's very methodic, you know, about his process. So I really have taken a lot of time to, you know, really try to reflect on what he's doing and bring my own, you know, knowledge. And I'm telling a lot of stories that have nothing to do with what he did, but I'm trying to imagine what's going on. So that's been a nice process.
And are the photographs also in this exhibition?
Yeah, we're showing them side by side.
Okay, this will be very interesting. Mm-hmm. And so
they're all the same size,
too. This is at Launchpad.
Yeah.
And that is located, can you just let us know here?
Yeah, it's 534 Southeast Oak.
Okay.
Right off Grand there.
And the opening is this Friday?
Yep, it's first Friday, this Friday. It's 6 to midnight.
So, all right. Mm-hmm. They're big parties, by the way.
Yeah, they are. There's a hula hoop always.
So you're telling us that the photographs and the paintings are the same size, and they're side by side?
Yeah, and they're the same price.
And they're the same price.
Yep.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. But are they both color or black and white? Or
There's two black and whites, and there's 19 color. So, and they're all different sizes, and all my paintings are made out of recycled materials, so his are all framed as photos are and should be.
Okay.
And all my stuff is made, I've made it all from recycled material that I find, and that's all my work is based off that. I find stuff on the street.
Okay, well, now let's just go through a piece then and tell me what that, like, I have a hard time visualizing that. What do you mean recycled material? Like, tell us what a piece is, how you started it or what you did.
Like a cabinet door is a basic one, like that's all set. But sometimes I just take like wood paneling off someone's house that has been recycled or left out, and then I'll cut it to what it needs to be, and I'll make a frame out of just scrap wood or basically whatever I have is what I use.
Mm-hmm.
And I use as much recycled paint as I can, too. I get recycled paint from Metro, and basically I started doing that only because canvas was too expensive and hard to stretch.
Yeah.
And time-consuming, and I started painting on this harder material, which I really started enjoying. And then the contour of the wood or this nail hole or something could become someone's eye. It all just kind of seemed to come together, and it was cheaper, and it was, you know, very green-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started doing that, I don't know if that was really my intention, was to just recycle, but it seemed to be a puzzle every time I was putting something together, so...
So that's part of it. So part of it for you is not only whatever image you're doing, but how you're putting it together. And do you find that sometimes you're getting, you come across, oh, I don't know, some cabinet doors, and there's 10 of them. So you realize right then there's a body of work,
yep.
10 paintings.
That's right.
There's an exhibition.
Mm-hmm. There's 10 people looking at me on the ground there. Or road signs, you know,
uh-huh.
Something like bed frames, like the back of a back of a bed frame is great. I paint on a pool table, and I paint on mattresses. And
wow, how about a whole door?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've done a lot
You've
of doors.
You've done a lot
yeah.
of those.
I've cut doors up and stuff. But yeah.
Right. Okay.
I didn't know how to woodwork at all before I started this, so it's all self-taught.
How long, but you said now when you first started doing this, though, it wasn't really about being green, but it's sort of now the world is, quote-unquote, supposedly so green.
Sure.
So how long have you been kind of painting with these recycled materials? And
I've been painting for about 6.5 years,
mm-hmm.
so about 6 years of mm-hmm. that. I took, at the end of my graduate period at Portland State, I was an English major.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a...
I took one painting class.
He's giving me a look
yeah.
like, uh-oh.
Yeah, I'm not an art guy. I mean, I didn't start out being one.
You didn't start out being one. Mm-hmm. You were going to Portland State. You were taking English. And what happened?
I was a writer. I just had some credits, and I really wanted to take a painting class, and it seemed like there were all these full, so I finally got into a very basic abstract color class. Taught by Margaret Shirley, who teaches at Laurelhurst College. So, Merrillhurst College.
Merrillhurst, all right.
And I think
yes.
she may be a PhD. But so I basically that's how I got into it. Yeah, I took
and
a class.
She just opened up the doors for you, huh?
Yeah, she said I had a lot of talent. Like she was very supportive of me right off the bat, and I was really quick, and I picked it up really quickly, and I just from there I was just an abstract painter for about a year, just working with that, and then all of a sudden. I made some circle in the canvas, and I kind of saw, like, this person's head. And then I started painting people, and then I started adding words because it seemed like it was all natural.
Mm-hmm.
The writer side came together with this, you know. I mean, I studied English, which has given me a large background of knowledge to be able to make paintings and have subject matter. So when I was a journalist major, you know, I started, I was in journalism.
Okay.
And they always told me never to major in journalism. You should major in poli sci, so you had something to write about. So I feel like this is very relevant to what I've done to be able to fuel the type of work I'm making.
Are you sometimes writing a lot? I mean, like, are there paintings of yours that have many, many words? Like, there's almost a page of a novel in them? I'm trying to imagine.
I have, like, 8x10 paintings that I've done where the entire background is full words. There's probably a good, you know, 4,000 words in there.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm not sure, I've done murals, too, where it's the background's all words. And
these are your own writings, your own
yeah.
coming from? Have you finished it? Like, are you still writing? And what kind of works? Are they short stories, novels, or what?
I'm writing mostly, like, poetry and prose.
Okay.
And I've had a show this last year that where I did 20 poems and then made a little book of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a painting of each poem. So, like... like we've talked, I've been doing a lot of theme shows, and that's been a great thing for me to pull back my poetry and my writing.
Uh-huh. So tell us what you mean by theme shows for those who don't know.
The instead of just, you know, producing some work and having it all together, I have themes in my shows. Like this one is I'm working with a photographer.
Okay.
Or I've done a show where it's all Portland streets. I've done 20 paintings of each, you know, all these major Portland streets.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the poetry show. Or I've done one just with faces. It's all faces.
It's all faces. Yeah. What do you think? Okay, you were doing the abstract paintings, and that didn't last for very long.
No.
But once you got into the figure or the face,
mm-hmm.
did you study that, or did you look at other art? Like, who was your teacher or your mentor towards the figure?
I think basically studying things, and I mean, I read a lot of comic books. I think pop culture is my
books.
Yeah.
Good.
Pop culture was my teacher, I think,
yes.
Basically, and
uh-huh.
I mean, I studied literature, which has always been in you know, arm in arm with art.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. The ideas that gives you the narrative, but I'm talking about aesthetics here.
Right.
drawing skills. So pop culture is it for you?
I mean, I've always drawn, mm-hmm. Since I was a little kid. Always couldn't stand the lines. You know, always drew a lot of comic book stuff. Wanted to write comic books.
Yes.
Drew the hamster on the matchbook. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I always did that stuff. My mom was very supportive. Coloring and things, but painting was definitely a different medium for me, so I didn't know, you know, how to do that. So I was really self-taught with that. But just drawing is the basic for all painting.
Yes,
you know, so
it is. And are you using acrylics, oil? What are you doing?
Mostly acrylic. Mm-hmm. I used to paint abstract oil, but it just takes too long to dry. And I don't like the smell of it. I'm really sensitive to smells.
Oh.
So
you can't do that then.
Yeah. I use a lot of ink now.
Yeah.
As much permanent stuff as I can. I'm trying to. I used to paint on cardboard forever. I would just pick up big like refrigerator boxes and paint on cardboard.
Yeah, but you've got to do something more substantial than that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to do something. Okay, let's talk a little bit about collaboration here. Mm-hmm. Because I went to another show of yours. And now that I think about it, it was sort of similar to what you're going to do this month here, where you're working with another artist and you work on something together. I saw you with Richard Schimmerer,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to me you were both doing idols and icons. Is that true?
Yeah.
You both worked on the same thing?
Yeah, we worked on the same idea. Again, we had no... We didn't really talk about it. We just talked really briefly about what we were going to do.
Right.
And then we ended up having a lot of the same subject matters. It was for Gay Pride last year at the Q Center.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
I loved the show, by the
thank
way.
Thank you
I
very
loved
much.
That show, yeah.
It was fun. I have a personal, friendship with Darcel, so I've done a lot of Darcel paintings. So,
oh, okay. Wow.
So that was always, anytime I have a chance to do Darcel, I'll do it, you know. So it was great. I did a lot of Portland icons and, you know, Richard and I really have a lot of color, types of colors that we love to work with. So I feel like that show really worked out well. And he produces more than I do, which is saying a lot because I paint a lot.
No, I can't believe
that.
Yeah,
he does.
Really?
Yes, he's a workhorse. Yeah,
he's a workhorse. Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. So, and what we mean by producing a lot is not only are you showing at Launchpad this month, but mm-hmm. tell us your next 6 month schedule.
The schedule?
Uh-huh.
Next month I show at the Goodfoot. Which
where's
this
that?
Will, that's on 28th and Southeast Stark.
Mm-hmm.
It's an old Mason Hall. This is the 8th year the Goodfoot's been there. They've had art on the walls ever since. 20-foot walls inside. It's definitely an art bar. It always has been. Really large shows. They have the largest poster show, one of the largest poster shows in the United States now. I'm showing with their curator. His name is Jason Brown. We're collaborating hardcore. We're going to show over 100 works in that show. And we're building, this show is called City of Night, after the Doors, you know, from L.A. Woman.
Okay.
But we're building a city inside the art bar, too. It's going to be all lit up. So that's our City of Light, and all the paintings are our City of Night.
Well, this sounds amazing. Okay, now let's get a little bit more about this. Okay, 100 works.
Yeah.
So are you each doing 50 or 100 works that you collaborate to get together?
It's kind of going back and forth right now. We're working. We're having play dates is what we're calling them. We're just basically painting together as much as we can.
But how big is this space?
It's pretty huge.
It's pretty huge.
Yeah, it's an old Mason Hall. So last year I showed 100 works myself. So,
mm-hmm.
In that space, this is my 5th year showing there. So this is a.
So this City of Light mm-hmm. sounds like it almost would be an installation.
It is. It's going to be permanent in the bar.
Permanent installation. So it's behind the bar.
No, it's going to be up above. There's a big. It's a pretty large space. Wow. Wait, you'll be there, so you'll see it.
Okay, I am going to try to. And tell me a little bit about who you're, the curator that you're
collaborating. Jason Brown is one of the, I mean, he's one of the best curators in Portland. He's really worked with a lot of people, and he also runs a frame shop called Poor Boy Art just up the street. We're all kind of in the neighborhood here. When I started going into that place and hanging out in Southeast Portland, he was a very prolific painter and showing all the time. And he was a large inspiration to me. And so he kind of moved from painter to curator almost permanently. So this is his first show in probably 3 years. So we're, you know, it's been really great. He works really quick, too. And he has a lot of people. And we have a lot of cities and buildings. And it's very urban. And, you know, there's a lot of language going on. His work is very... it's kind of like Dolly. His people have really long limbs and things.
A little surrealist.
And I don't really draw hands.
No?
I always have people with pockets and stuff, so he's taking over the hand duty because his hands are great.
Fabulous. That is kind of like the old masters, where if there was somebody that would be very good at the hands, and they did the hands on all the paintings.
Sure.
Just want to remind you all that you are listening to KBOO Portland, and my name is Ava Lake, and I'm talking with Chris Haberman, who has got shows all over town, but the one that's opening up this week is at Launchpad Gallery, and we also are talking about one that's happening in May, which is a Goodfoot Lounge. All right, you have a little bit of a relationship with Wieden Kennedy, and you're doing some kind of project with them. I'd like to hear a little bit about that one.
I'm going to be teaching. I do have a relationship. Originally, I sold a painting to a member of Wieden Kennedy, a very large painting. I did the History of Burnside. That was about a year ago. It took me 4 months to research it, and I did the entire history and
all the characters.
I did everything. I got from Mary's Club to Dr. Hawthorne, like the whole everything.
Ringside Lounge.
Yeah, it was all. It's on there. I know all the bum bars. It's good. So they've been very supportive of me, and I've worked events like and done some work with Caldera also. So basically, what's going to happen is I'm going to teach two or three workshops in May with Caldera to kids. And then there's going to be first Thursday of June, I'm going to do a live paint, and the kids are going to get all the words for me that are going to be on the backdrop of a permanent piece that's going to be in Caldera, in Wieden and Kennedy.
So was this something you applied to Caldera for?
No, they contacted me. I was in another thing. They asked me to donate something to Caldera.
Okay.
Like donating things and working charity things have always come back for me. It's a good thing to do anyway, but it's always a really good thing personally, too, because it seems that you make more connections with people, and things feel good, but it also, you know, helps.
Things come back.
Things do come back.
Things come back. And
OPB's going to film that, too.
Oh.
So I'm on OPB in June for
Art Beat. That's a great thing. Yeah. That is a great thing. And, well, it's a good thing I got you first.
Yeah, that's right.
That's all I can say. And you also have, of all things, a book coming out. Is this true? Collaboration with 23
Sandy Gallery, Laura Russell.
What's happening with that?
I'm producing... Well, this was definitely her idea. She wanted to put a book out. She's a photography gallery on 23 Sandy, and I'm the only painter that showed with her. And so she invited me back this year, and she wants to put out a book. So I've been doing 20 plates of Alice in Wonderland paintings, and she's reproducing the book in its entirety. So, and that's first Friday of July. So we're going to do a hardbound edition first, and then she's producing paperback. So
where could we get this book?
I think basically through her right now. I think it's going to – I mean, we're still working on
– maybe eventually on Amazon or
– yeah, definitely. Barnes & Noble, I think, is going to definitely carry it.
Good. Good. And what are the images you're saying, Alice in Wonderland, or what's the deal with that?
She's reprinting the book in its entirety, so that all the text is there. And I'm redoing John Tenniel's plates in my own style, and the cover of the Mad Tea Party. basically, I'm just completely illustrating Alice in Wonderland, the first book.
Right.
So it's been really great, and it's been a lot of research for me. It's totally up my alley to be able to do a project like this, and it's been a lot of work. I mean, I've really done a lot of research and reread Alice in Wonderland like 3 times now, so it's been a good return to my literature roots. But also, like, there's a bunch of Portland stuff in there. Like, I love to take everything and encompass all pop culture and history of something and put it all together and try to, you know, my big college words juxtaposition, and I think it still works. So I think that happens a lot. Like, I juxtapose something new, like an urban environment with...
Very current,
you know, with like a, you know, the classic Alice in Wonderland feel, which is, you know, Alice in Wonderland had a lot of stuff going on in its current day,
Yes.
He was, you know, really good with that. So it was like James Joyce, like they were very good.
Lewis Carroll.
Yeah. James Joyce, like mm-hmm. Lewis Carroll, they mm-hmm. were both very people that the intertextuality between their present day and, you know, the classic Greeks and the Bible, and they really got a lot of things all together.
Oh, question. Okay, studio. Where's your studio? And, like, is it big? I'm just curious, like...
I have two studios.
You must have room to accommodate this kind of input, output, however...
I have a studio at my home off Interstate, and then I also, I'm just down the street here at the old building called Twist.
Big.
Yeah, it's pretty big,
comes with quite a bit of...
Yeah.
All right, I want to talk to you now, though, a little bit about curating and about helping other artists and working with emerging artists and all of that, because actually I think that kind of work has got to be equally important, even though Lord knows we have time for it.
Yeah.
but I think it might be part of the reason why you are so productive, because I personally know that the more contact I have with other artists, the more I work.
Definitely.
The more I work. So tell us how that works for you.
Well, I walked in this really accidentally.
It kicks your butt, right?
It does. It's really, my schedule is pretty crazy. My family's really supportive, thank God, you know, but, it makes me a really busy painter. It enriches my life to be able to produce work so quickly and to work with so many artists. I work with I'm close to 500 plus artists in Portland
that you've done something with or promoted or curated.
Or they're in my little family.
They're in your sphere.
Yeah.
So what are you doing at Olympic Mills and East Bank and all of this? Like how'd you get all of that and what's exactly going on there?
They're industrial spaces. They're semi creative commercial. So there's basically small businesses in both these buildings, and they've given their lobby areas, their main courtyard areas, as public galleries. So we're operating those as public galleries.
Mm-hmm.
It's free to the public to come in. We run large shows now. Olympic Mills is a 24,000 square foot space. So
you have a special show every month, or
I do like bi-monthly shows, but it looks like through the summer I'm doing these four artist series. So mm-hmm. I do monthly shows as well.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what's going on or what's happening in the schedule. Or
do they give you a budget? I mean, like.
Now I just opened a nonprofit to run these places.
Okay.
So I'm with artist John Grader in Portland, who's been really mm-hmm. supportive of me in the last year since knowing him. So we've decided to start a nonprofit because I also have. I also have an event in July with the Art Institute. We're going to do a live paint-off similar to the one that mm-hmm. I met you at Art Media. I'm going to have 100 painters paint in the park blocks downtown. And then we're going to have an auction for doors. They're going to paint on found doors and donated doors. And the Art Institute is going to have a block party in July.
Right.
Or, excuse me, in August.
Uh-huh.
And then, these building events where I worked with Beam Development and Brad Nelson, who's been very supportive of the creative arts in Portland, I just kind of... got into that area, and everything's happened by accident. And
sort of one thing leads to another, but you know what you need? Just a piece of advice for me. You need a website that puts all this stuff together.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, I know that you do all these things,
mm-hmm.
but I have to do a lot of detective work
right.
to find out that you do all these things.
Sure.
And, like, for instance, your curating and all that should be maybe a little bit easier to find. Like, tell us a little bit about the summer programming that you're doing four artist shows.
I'm doing, four artists each month.
Small group shows, then.
Well, in Olympic Mills, which is a huge space, so it's basically four solo shows. Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what kind of artist interests you. Who are you, for those listening, who want to show their work, for what interests you?
I mean, my interests are range. I like people that come to Portland that have shown other places. I love meeting people new to the city. I love meeting people that have been here for a long time. I'm a big fan of Tom Kramer. In Portland.
Well, we love him. We love him, man. He's the man.
Tom Kramer's a cool guy.
Okay.
And he was really influential to me for the fact that he got together with a lot of older artists that came before him and introduced them back into what was happening then in the now. So I have really tried to do that. I curated a City Hall show 2 years ago, brought a lot of people, the different generation from Portland, and mixed them with younger
mm-hmm.
people, too. I love really innovative art. I like a lot of passion in art. I like a lot of color.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody wants to show you their work, how do they get things to you? Does that happen?
I have a MySpace for almost everything. That's kind of my MySpace.
That's how you do things. And of course, you're just out there meeting people. So I guess that's some of it just happens. Huh?
Definitely, people get a hold of me.
People get a hold. Let's talk a little bit about. Well, you know, what kind of advice would you have for, you know, one thing that you and I talked about off the mic was that there are so many people that are going to art school and they're coming out with these MFAs and what have you, and then there's not really a big system here to support that.
Right.
What do you want to tell young artists or emerging artists? Want to give them some advice?
Well, Portland's definitely a hard market. I mean, there's the, you know, that we call it like the $500 curtain or whatever. You can't sell something.
It?
Yeah, something like that. The curtain keeps lowering and raising at different points. But I work with a lot of people that are pretty affordable. I mean, I think a lot of people in Portland, you know, the Joe Blue Collar will only spend so much. So if people can, you know, if you really want to make art and you really want to make a lot of art, you can't store that art, and that's the problem I had, and I started to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do work with a lot of people like that that can produce a lot and that love to paint. They just want to paint. They don't the sales thing is, you know, to the side. But also, I mean, I work with people that sell really high-priced work as well. So I think the new artists, I would say, like, Portland's a hard market, but it's a great place to produce art.
To produce art.
And that's why people come here, and I mean, that's why we have – I just got back from L.A., so, I mean, it's a totally different market from place to place. But I think the people coming from art school, they really need to, you know, just kind of relax a little bit and look at the real-world marketplace. I mean, that's kind of what
– The reality check, huh?
Sure, just a little bit of, you know, what's going on. Like, what is my art, especially if I don't have a name, which it's too bad that we have to have names in the
people
world.
People like to feel like they know something when they buy work.
Definitely,
I find.
Sure, and there's a lot of new artists that are making great work, but their work's, like, really expensive and people don't know who they are and it's hard. I think you have to be, as Mark Twain said, you have to be your own self-promoter. That's really important, you know,
right,
to really promote yourself and talk to people.
And you know what I was thinking, too? It seems to me like maybe, you know, you're kind of like one of the princes of the East Side,
Sure, right.
Okay, all right. And I'm thinking, you know, as the West in some ways may crumble here with the economic crisis, are you feeling a little renewed pressure or a little renewed importance or invigorating from the fact that, you know, a lot of what's going on is things open. It's going to open here. It's not going to open over there.
Sure. No, it's very true. I feel like the West is coming to the East right now for Portland.
I
find there's a lot of bridge traffic right now.
Okay.
And especially places like the Good Foot and other venues in Portland.
Uh-huh.
I feel like we have a lot of Pearl traffic. I'm really happy with the Pearl. Like, I'm from Portland. I'm a native Portlander.
Oh, really?
I'm really happy with the fact that the Pearl's there. It's our little gateway.
Yes.
It's good.
I have happy memories there.
It's good. But it helps artists here sell work all over across the United States to be able to. People come to the Pearl and they do buy art. I mean, it happens all the time. But I love the East Side. It's great. It's a wonderful. I live in Northeast, so, but, you know, it's still the East Side.
Yes. Yes. Well, I just think that, you know, there was a lot of sort of doom and gloom that's been in the press about, you know, places closing down. And that, for the most part, I think is really established places, which we need so much.
Sure.
But with that, hopefully some new things are going to open up that are artist-driven.
Definitely.
And you're kind of an example of that.
Well, the public gallery thing and public space is really important, I think. You know, we have empty buildings in Portland that could have art in them. And I think that that's where I'm starting to come into the thing, and that's where, you know, the people I work with were enabling people to show. Like, you just need to be able to show. I mean, selling is the second part, and it's nice to sell, but showing is really important for yourself as an artist.
Do you think that these real estate developers and these people who have real estate, they're realizing that you're something, you know, that someone like you can help them out?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
These people open.
Yeah.
You've got connections to other pieces of property.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening in Portland. We have a lot of different, I mean, we have a lot of building still happening here. I mean, they've, you know, there's a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think every condo should have a painting in it right now.
I agree with. It's just getting it to them. And also, you mentioned a few art bars that you curate at. What places are we talking about here?
I curate The Nest on Alberta. It's just a little bar.
What's the Nest?
It used to be Joe's Place.
Okay.
So it's a nice neighborhood bar for people to, if you're just looking for a show. It was a pretty smoky bar, but the smoking bands really opened up a lot of stuff, too. So I'm happy with that. I've sold a lot of work out of bars in Portland. So bars, restaurants, cafes are still little galleries here, which is nice. A lot of places don't have that. People have shows and have people come to a reception at a cafe. So, I mean, that's, you know, these are our little, you know, finite galleries that people may overlook, but they totally sell. I mean, people sell.
Well, gee, Chris, thanks so much for joining us on KBOO.
Great.
Yes, and just to remind you all that he's got a show that's opening up on Friday, right?
Yep.
Friday, and what is the name of it? People Will Talk?
People Will Talk.
People Will Talk, which is a collaboration of paintings and photography. Photographer is his name?
Mark Wickham.
And this is at Launchpad, which you can go to launchpad.org, I believe, mm-hmm. or Google Launchpad Gallery and get more information. Also wanted to remind you that you can go to our own homepage, kboo.fm/artfocus, and you can see past interviews. I've uploaded MP3 files and links to galleries and artists' websites and posted a few images. Also just want to let you know that next week I have a true art star with me, which is Eric Stodick. Eric Stodick, who is showing at Laura Russo Gallery. So thanks so much for listening to Art Focus, and I'll be talking with you next week.
KBOO Portland.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, March 31st. Portland Central America Solidarity Committee meets Wednesday, April 1st, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Liberty Hall, 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. PCASC is a grassroots organization working for international solidarity and immigrant rights. This is a general meeting for anyone interested in Latin American solidarity work, local immigrant rights work, or fighting free trade agreements. The Sister Circle Support Group meets Wednesday, April 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. The Sister Circle is a support group for women of color in higher education, which meets biweekly on Wednesdays in the Women's Resource Center at Portland State University. Children are always welcome in the space. The facilitators of this group are Erica Lee Johnson, president of the NAACP, and Carmen Anderson, coordinator of the Returning Women's Program. United Poor People attends Portland City Council meetings Wednesday morning between 9 a.m. and 12 noon to lobby for the rights of the homeless. Every citizen of Portland is allowed 3 minutes to address the mayor and city council. The UPP also meets in Chapman Square across from City Hall every day at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Meetings are consensus-based and open to the public. The People's Farmers Market takes place Wednesdays, 2 to 7 p.m. It's a year-round market at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell Boulevard. Knitters, crocheters, needlepoint artists, and other crafters come to the Cube Space Wednesday nights from 5 to 6 p.m. to show off your current project, ask for advice on a problem, or just enjoy the company. The Cube Space is at 622 Southeast Grand Avenue, Portland. There is a free sack lunch concert Wednesday, April 1st at noon at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Muriel Hurst student Ebony Terrell presents a piano recital. Do you want to take that next step as a member and become a volunteer? There are many varied trainings and events you can be part of. Contact Ani, KBOO Volunteer Coordinator. Email at volunteer@kboo.fm or call the station at 503-231-8032, extension 213. This has been Paula for the community calendar for KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio transmitting from Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.